Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. My special guest today is Ryan Wood. Ryan and his late father, in my opinion, the late, great Robert Wood, put together the Majestic website, the Majestic Papers, and Ryan is also an author of books about the UFO subject. I've been really looking forward to the discussion. So without any further ado, Ryan Wood, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Well, thank you. Thanks, James, and welcome all your viewers. I'm excited to share what I can about Majestic Documents and the ufological phenomenon and its challenges.
Absolutely. One of my favorite subjects also is right in your bailiwick, the subject of UFO crash retrievals, which has been all in the news in the recent past. I want to get back to the provenance of some of the Majestic Papers. In intelligence espionage tradecraft, it's very normal for an agent in place, a spy in place, to not only have access to material information, but the proper usage of it requires that agent to reword, rephrase the document, and then forward it to his case officer, transmit it, whatever the case may be, because in the past we've seen in regular espionage history, when these agents have forwarded a complete document in its entirety, it led to their arrest eventually. This happened to Claus Fuchs. I think it happened to Donald McLean as well. I bring that up because the source who called himself Thomas Cantwell apparently had this treasure trove of documents going back to the 1940s. And in true espionage tradecraft, he reworded some of the documents and then forwarded it to researcher Timothy Cooper. Eventually, it got to your team, you and your dad. I wanted you to talk about that whole process of how it played out between Tim Cooper, yourselves, and Thomas Cantwell, because I think that the documents provided by this Thomas Cantwell are invaluable. You have the floor.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing to do is to back up a little bit and talk about the Majestic documents in their totality, for example, and then go dive into that specific source there. So Majestic documents originally leaked in 1984 as undeveloped film to Jamie Chandra, an L.A. producer, with the Eisenhower briefing document, which is was undeveloped film that Jamie Chandra developed and Stan Friedman did lots of research on and wrote a book about it. And that was the first leak. And then 1994, 10 years later, we had the Special Operations Manual, Extraterrestrial Entities, Technology, Recovery, and Disposal, which was a dedicated website to that, specialoperationsmanual.com, where we again have a undeveloped film that is mailed to Don Berliner in Washington, D.C., who is an Aviation Week and Space reporter from La Crosse, Wisconsin. And each of these has their own sort of 10-minute discussion of authenticity. And then you sort of get to the documents from mail to Tim Cooper in Big Bear Lake. There's And these happened in 95, 6, 7, 8, 9, all the way to 2000. And they come in a variety of forms, some as mailbox drops, some as, personal handoff from Thomas Cantwell to Tim Cooper. Some were mailed from Sacramento, California. So there's a variety of different sort of sources, I would say three or four different sources that triangulate through Tim Cooper, not necessarily all from Thomas Cantwell. And then you go on to talk about the Bowen manuscript, which was a 300-page original typeset document that was mailed to Tim Cooper, again, from the Freedom Information Act office in Fort Meade, which is stamped Top Secret Magic. There's a whole dedicated book on Amazon to that document and its authenticity called The Encyclopedia of Flying Saucers by Vernon Bowen. So that's the sort of broad brush of the Majestic document, some 3,500 pages from these 7 different sources spanning some 18 years. And circling back, James, to your original sort of tradecraft and spycraft scenario is that, you know, if you're trying to deceive somebody and plant false intelligence, you don't have such a wide variety of quality of documents and spread over such a long time from such disparate sources for basically the public, you know, ufology to see and deal with. You know, if I'm the CIA saying, Russians, you don't fuck with us because we have ET technology, I'm going to leak something directly to a spy or spy organization within Russia and not let the public touch it at all. So anyway, that was the long-winded sort of open preamble. Hopefully that helped orient everybody.
Yes, it did. And you have this authentication process you and your team went through. And I was struck by the fact that a number of the experts you consulted from the printing presses in those days, they remarked about how some of these documents had these telltale markers which showed up frequently with known official documentation. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think you're referring to the Special Operations Manual, Extraterrestrial Entities, Technology, Recovery, and Disposal. And of all the documents my father and I have worked on, this is the one that is at the highest level of authenticity, the most things that we've checked, the most, you know, if I was to bet, I would say this is the most authentic and most real. It also happens to be the most stunning document in that it's here's the purpose of the group. Here's how you create cover stories around deceiving the public when there's a crash retrieval event. Here's where to send the parts. Here's where to send the bodies. Here's where to send clothing. Here's where to send the weapons. Here's how to package it up. I mean, it's a manual, you know, 35-page, 32-page manual on how to deal with crash retrievals, written in 1954, although the last page in the change control page, which is sort of the internal approach to how you manage this document, is 1957, I think. The authenticity of that manual, we looked at things like, we interviewed, as you mentioned earlier, Robert McCarter, a government printing style manual expert. So this is a person who spends his life monitoring the quality and creating guidelines for printing government documents. We visited his house in Virginia, and my father and I, this was maybe in the 90s, I think, late 90s, we showed him the document, we slid it across the table, and he looked at it and flipped through the pages and said, well, the Z in synchronizer, which is raised off the line, so he concluded that it's clearly hot lead printing press. Is that, yep, this is an artifact of the monotype modern hot lead printing press that was widely in use. And furthermore, I think the CIA printed it down on 10th Street in a cage, you know, in his opinion. But it might have been printed at Holloman Air Force Base, for example, in a cage in that time frame. So that's just one little subtlety around the authenticity of that document. And there's lots more to say, but I'll pause there.
Yeah, and the significance of that document, like you said, it's quite stunning because it's a manual for field operators in order to deal with crash retrieval events. And it goes into minute detail of what to do with the bodies, where to send them, et cetera, et cetera. And it's very topical today, as you know, Ryan, because in the recent past, we've had this spate of whistleblowers come forward talking about their knowledge about UFO crash retrievals. From your perspective, does this seem to be a worldwide issue? Because it seems to me a country as vast as the former Soviet Union / Russia or China, they would have had crash retrievals at some point, I would think. What do your sources tell you? And then What do you know about any crashes behind the Iron Curtain, for example, during the Cold War era?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point, James, is that I think that the phenomenon of crashes is clearly global in nature. And, you know, yes, there's crashes in Russia, and my book, you know, Magic Eyes Only, not only has a special operations manual in the back for people to read in detail, but there's some Russian cases that are written up, but it's difficult, and I'm sure that China has some too. But in my process, I mean, I'm biased towards English-speaking environments where I can pick up information out of Europe and the UK and the US, and to some extent, South America, where there's reporting. But, you know, the Chinese have a big UFO investigation and organization, and I think there are probably lots of Chinese crash retrieval events, as well as Russians. You never know how far up the chain of command it goes, or, you know, you're stuck with, we have this advanced thing. We don't know how it operates. We can't seem to fly it. And it's clearly well beyond our science. What now? What to do with it? Well, let's put it in a museum. Let's study it. Let's try to get more PhDs in fusion and metallurgy and stuff like that. Try to figure it out. So, you know, my soapbox is the great crime against humanity is that 1,000 cloistered scientists within the deep bowels of China, Russia, U.S., and other countries possibly are doing this all in secret rather than leveraging the 100 million scientists and engineers throughout the globe that could figure out the science.
Yeah, that was Bob Lazar's beef. One of the things that compelled him to come out was he felt it was a crime that this little group of scientists out in the middle of the desert should have all this technology and essentially hoard it for themselves. In reading some of those documents, I was struck by the fact that it seems that at a relatively early age or period in the late 1940s, a decision was made to bring in private industry. In fact, if memory serves, I was reading this bit about Dr. Theodore von Karman, a key player in all this, making a recommendation in one of these committee meetings about bringing private industry into the picture. And now we're hearing from these whistleblowers that, yes, there are contractors involved, of course, the aerospace giants, but they're actually have created teams of these specialists to retrieve these craft. But a lot of them nowadays tend to be of the contract variety. Did you want to comment on how that process unfolded from your perspective?
Yeah. Well, the notion of compartmentalization in security and science has probably been around since the early 1900s, but really got going, you know, more during World War II. And you would naturally want experts in, let's say, metallurgy to focus on the skin of the craft. And you might, in the World War II timeframe or post, tap the best and brightest minds of the PhDs in various universities or international organizations that would have expertise around that. And they wouldn't know anything about the propulsion or where it came from or anything else. They would be in their little tunnel vision of, let's focus on these rare, weird things and try to write reports and analyze that. And so I think there'd be multiple groups, you know, propulsion and biology and materials, and certainly the bifurcation of alien bodies and the whole biological science is a whole separate zone, and materials and propulsion and weapons, maybe whatever they can sort of figure out how to try to work on. And, you know, I'm reminded of, you know, a Russian nesting doll as the sort of thing. You know, you have story within a story within a story, and a code word within a code word, a special access program that's deeper and deeper and more obscure, and very few people know the full picture.
It seems that there's been this push and pull these last decades, several decades now, between a group that seems, a faction that seems at all hazards to keep this under wraps, that they do not want this information to get out to the general public, even to general industry. And it seems that they will stop at nothing in order to do that. And yet there seems to be this other faction gradually, incrementally spoon-fed, if you will, some of this information out into the public. What's your thoughts about these two seemingly competing factions and perhaps, you know, degrees, all points in between? What seems to be going on the inside? Because it seems now that there seems to be earnest efforts to get this information out, and yet some of these whistleblowers are describing the same thing that's happened to whistleblowers in the past: harassment, removal of security clearances, break-ins into their homes, etc. Well, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, the control group, you know, MJ-12 or whatever the new name is, you know, their mission and agenda is to focus on controlling the hardware, controlling the technology, controlling the bodies and access to that, and controlling the ultimate secret, which is gravity control. That's the most destabilizing aspect of this technology, along with potential, you know, in some of the Majestic documents, they talk about serums collected from the ET bodies from Roswell could offer the potential for fantastic biological or virological weapons. So, you know, maybe back in the 50s, at the height of that whole effort of biological and virological weapons, that they, oh yeah, let's take some ET serums and crossbreed it with smallpox or MAR-B, or, you know, see what we can do is create a weapon. And then maybe they got some sanity and said, oh, this is really bad, we don't want to do this, and sort of shied away from all that. But maybe they still kept it. They don't know. So in my opinion, what they're protecting is the secrets of gravity control. They may not have gotten that secret at all from the ETs. I mean, they got a saucer and they know the physics is all wrong. And, you know, this is the go fast, and everything that we've seen in the modern times is that everybody says, hey, this physics of 90 degree right angle turns at 1,000 G's is not going to work. They're clearly manipulating time, dimension, space, matter, you know. They have gravity control of some sort. And maybe as, you know, as early as 1933, as David Grush has highlighted, or 41 in Cape Girardeau, they had craft and physicists saying, well, it must work some other way. And so we need to go back to Einstein's equations and Maxwell's equations and figure out, where did we go wrong? We need to do experiments and figure this out. And that's what I think really happened in the mid-50s with a lot of different aerospace corporations to work on gravity control. And I think that they succeeded in that. And that's the most highly classified secret on planet Earth.
Yes, I would agree, because that level of technology would literally allow elements of the human race to get off this planet and explore the cosmos. What do you see coming out? I mean, what's there left for these whistleblowers to reveal? Because I would think that there would be limitations to what some of these whistleblowers today would want. Some are hinting that there's a dark aspect to this. I would agree. And others are talking, understandably, about the beneficial aspects of this to widespread humanity. Like they seldom talk about alien abductions, encounter reports. There's been reports that bodies other than alien bodies have been found in some of these craft. What would be some of the things besides the gravity aspect and control of gravity aspect would seem to be deterrent to getting this information out?
Yeah. The other things that are kind of sensational that may be leaked, you know, for example, in one of the Majestic documents in the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit document of the IPU, which was acknowledged as being a real organization within the counterintelligence core, technical and scientific branch that possibly Thomas Cantwheel worked at, is, you know, well, we found parts of sheep and cattle and other body parts inside these Roswell craft. And so the whole notion of cattle mutilations and body parts, let alone maybe a more sensational thing, that there's quite a number of cases that are strong, are human mutilations, where the eyes are gone and the tongue is gone and many other sort of similar to cattle mutilations, but with humans. So that's one aspect that could come out. And then the whole notion of treaties. And, you know, I mean, if you take the work of, for example, Dan Sherman in his book Above Black, You know, so here's a firsthand witness that stands up and says, yeah, I worked at the NSA. I was a psychic. I was tasked with mental communication at multiple levels with alien species and translated that and plugged it into the NSA system. And we had a relationship going on following guidelines and rules and a treaty. Yeah, well, you get technology, humans, and we abduct your people. That's the general principle, allegedly, of what's going on with that. So, I mean, that's potentially pretty disturbing. You know, it's Congress didn't, the Senate didn't validate that treaty. And it was the more whistleblowers may come forward and say there's crash retrievals and, you know, there's more podcasts, people coming out. Yeah, I was part of a crash retrieval team that went out. I mean, it's the Barber recent case. So I think there's just more dribs and drabs of slow evidence. I think there's a lot of evidence still in the National Archives in the form of remnants, sort of lost material or suggestive material. They don't even know where to look. They have no idea of how, most people have no idea of how vast the paper trail is or could be, even after people try to find it all and squirrel it away and take it out of any sort of public access or even classified access at the National Archives.
Yes, well, we saw the efforts of stonewalling Congressman Stephen Schiff of New Mexico, and ultimately he died of a fast-acting cancer. I had Donald Schmidt on the show talking about that. Also, in some of the early Majestic committee papers, they specifically mentioned cultural relations, if memory serves, if that was a term. And I could only interpret that to mean cultural relations with some of the occupants of some of these craft they've been retrieving, because if they found survivors in some of these craft, that is de facto communication contact between our civilization and another civilization right off the bat, even if there was only one survivor. And we know that over time there have been many of these. So one can only ponder the depth and the scale of these cultural relations, where they would be at now at this point.
Yeah. And that's a fascinating point, James. And I would go to actually one of the more interesting Majestic documents, the Einstein-Oppenheimer document, which is sort of a think piece, in my opinion, in our forensic work, is written by Einstein. You know, why are they here? What happens if they want to settle here? What does international law say about this? And it's a 5-page memo. Vannevar Bush, you know, makes handwritten notes on the back of it. And Oppenheimer makes some, you know, signs along with Einstein, I think, just out of formality. But that's a very interesting thought piece, which is on majesticdocuments.com that people can read. And from a forensic point of view, we used forensic linguistics on the validation of that particular document. We took existing 1947, 46, 48 known writing by Einstein and gave it to Carol Chowski, a forensic linguistics expert, as well as another one. And had they do a question document side by side comparison and compare, you know, adverbial clauses and sentence lengths and use of commas and the whole writing style, the fingerprinting of Einstein's writing, and the correlations were off the charts. It was like 99% that it was clearly Einstein. And furthermore, it was clearly not Timothy Cooper, who, you know, had the documents, and it was not Oppenheimer, who also allegedly signed the document. So that's just an example of the forensic part that we did for that particular document, which I'm highly confident is another one that's very interesting. Let me grab it for a second. You know, just read a couple of sections of it, just to give the audience a flavor. Of it. It's titled Relationships with Inhabitants of Celestial Bodies. And actually, one of the critiques has been celestial is misspelled. And so you say, that's a problem. I mean, we don't know. I suspect that Einstein is dictating this in German to his secretary, who's typing it. And she's, you know, a classified secretary, no doubt. And she may not have known how to spell celestial. She's pretty consistent with the misspelling of it. But anyway, you know, that's sort of a sidebar of authenticity. But, you know, it starts off, relationships with extraterrestrial men present no basically new problem from the standpoint of international law, but the possibility of confronting intelligent beings that do not belong to the human race would bring a problem solution is difficult to conceive. I mean, that's the opening paragraph. And it goes on to talk about Homo sapiens in our solar system. Now we come to the problem of determining what to do if the inhabitants of celestial bodies or extraterrestrial biological entities, EBEs, desire to settle here. You know, and so what do we do? I mean, I suspect they're already here.
Yes.
You know, they're in Antarctica, they're underground, they're in Alaska, the world's a big place. I mean, this clearly, what do we got, 10,000 ETs here or something? I mean, you could stuff them, all over the place. I mean, Canada's massive. Australia's huge. I mean, allegedly, Mount Zeal near Pine Gap is allegedly a base for UFO, I mean, for alien-human sort of interaction. Somebody ought to go hard on that, and let's get some seismographs out there. Let's get some video out there. Let's start interviewing witnesses. Let's take that that location to the next level. Get some remote viewing targets done around there, and really try to dig in and see, well, is he being cloaked? What's really going on? I don't know. I'm just sort of sidebarring. So sorry, James.
No, those are all valid points. I think it was the late Pat Price, a remote viewer with Stanford Research Institute, who pinpointed Mount Zeal as one of three bases, underground bases, that he'd identified in his remote viewing. And, you know, like Georgi Markov on the Waterloo Bridge in London, he was jabbed with some kind of pointed object coming in or out of a casino in Las Vegas, and he died, right? So, there is, unfortunately, this trail of death that revolves around this subject. And people have to understand the seriousness of this, because many of these whistleblowers now, they're dealing with the same issues our whistleblowers have in the past. If they're ex-military, they probably have a pension, which they would like to keep, especially in this economic era, right? So there's a number of things that would militate against people coming out. I mean, is it really worth it from their family standpoint to undergo all of this?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. I mean, this is why you need serious capital and money to protect whistleblowers. I mean, if you just have one whistleblower, you need at least $1 million. You got to buy an insurance policy for them if they die, to protect their family. You got to assume that their pension is going to be erased. You have to be able to support them and protect them, depending upon how high level it is. And when I step back and say, you know, what is wrong with ufology in a big sense, I think of three things. I think of credibility, was not enough of it. We're not, you know, we're marginalized and we're skeptical. Credibility, leadership of, you know, trying to enable more people to do the right thing and come forward and advocate for amplifying this discussion. The work of your podcast and many others is an example of leadership, people that write books and so forth. And then finally, the biggest elephant in the room is money. It's the financing. How do you have millions of dollars available to support whistleblowers, to do more investigations, to find more crash retrievals, to find more evidence, to do more scientific analysis, to market and do the public relations efforts around this topic. And there's a large number of, murders, as you mentioned earlier, that are, linked to this, particularly in the past. I mean, people think of Forrestal being thrown out a window, or Oppenheimer dying of cancer or even Einstein dying of cancer.
Yes, there were a number of people who seemed to me to have died at an early age, like the weaponeer, the head of the ordnance division at Los Alamos, Deke Parsons. The official story goes that he was so troubled by the security clearance issue that Oppenheimer, his good friend, was going through that he keeled over dead of a heart attack. This is a guy that was inside the bomb bay of the Enola Gay, arming it in mid-flight, right? And we're supposed to believe he just keeled over. Lloyd Bruckner, apparently, thanks to the efforts of dark journalists, I wasn't aware of this. He had an untimely death when he was meeting with JFK. Hoyt Vandenberg, even, General Hoyt Vandenberg, a guy who led bombing missions against the Axis in the Mediterranean, North Africa, he keels over, right? So some of the early major players involved with Majestic, to me, had untimely deaths.
Yeah, no, I agree. And actually, I gave a talk at the, I think it was the 2003 UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, the first one, called Murder in MJ-12. And I went through a long list of people that were, murdered and how, well, allegedly murdered, but how did they die? And then what's the probability of chance, or what is the insurance actuarial tables tell me about the probability that they would just die randomly of that? And then, do the math and say, here's the statistics. And the chance that all these people, the statistics were, huge P factor. And it was clear that there was something going on. I think of Colby, the former head of the CIA.
Yes.
He goes for a canoe ride down a, and suddenly dies of a heart attack. No. I think a Navy SEAL just swam out there, flipped him over, and drowned him.
Yes. And people don't understand the backgrounds of these people. William Colby, if memory serves, he was a Jedburgh from the OSS in World War II. That's what he did. He raised and led partisan groups behind German lines. So the guy wasn't like a wilted flower, and he would just drown, right? A lot of things that don't add up. One of the things that also interested me that jumped out from the Majestic papers was, from an early point, they recognized the importance of miniaturization and what have you, and specifically related it to the efforts of MIT. And we know that Vannevar Bush was the dean of MIT, and some of the key scientists came from that nexus around MIT. What are your thoughts about that? Because, well, miniaturization, nanotechnology is what we would call it today, is all in the news, along with AI. It seems to me that a lot of the things that were found in the Roswell debris field and other crashes led directly to the state we're in now. And I remind people, the Wright brothers got off the ground in 1903, thereabouts. Here we are, 143 years later. Look what we have around us, right? So there had, like Herman Oberth said, there had to be some assistance that came from somewhere.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think the air accident report on the Majestic Documents website, there's a discussion of sort of glass fibers with a cladding wrap. And that is the sort of core breakthrough in fiber optics, is this glass with this wrap around it. It happens to be glass, to increase the signal to noise ratio within the glass fibers to enable fiber optics. And I mean, Colonel Corso wrote the book The Day After Roswell that went through a lot of different technologies, from night vision goggles to fiber optics, and also integrated circuits.
Yes.
I mean, we had the transistor in 47 and the work of Shockley and others. And I think that was genuine. But from the Roswell environment, they clearly had chips. And they could whip out their microscope and look at it and say, oh my goodness, look at all these little interconnections. And it's like if you crack open your iPhone today and strip off the backing of the the chip back there and put it under a microscope, you go, wow, that's where we need to go. And so the whole notion of integrated circuits, I think, is something that, not to dismiss the hard work of the scientists at Intel and the 8080 and that whole trajectory of microprocessor development. I mean, we did that, but the seed, the yes. inside of how to start this, go down this path, we know it's possible, came from ETs.
Yes, I used to work in the semiconductor industry in Silicon Valley. In fact, I mass produced those lead frames, but you put the silicon chips in, right? And Intel, AMD, all these companies, remember old RCA, they were even in that game before they phased out. In the time we got left in this first segment, it's been a fascinating discussion, Ryan. Thank you so much for coming on. In the recent past, we've had this Oppenheimer biopic come out, and I think they could have easily chopped out 45 minutes from that movie. It would have been fine. But point of relevance is, I thought it was interesting that the guy who chaired the Oppenheimer security clearance hearing, Donald Gray himself, was one of the MJ-12ers, and he had a role in the creation of the Psychological Strategy Board of the CIA, which, to my mind, played a role in creating this whole debunking, ridiculing, cover-up factor. And like, what are the odds that a guy in MJ-12 that also would share the Oppenheimer security clearance hearing and deem that, yes, Oppenheimer was security risk, keeping in mind the possibility, even if Oppie himself wasn't an active agent in place for the Soviets, there is no doubt that he recruited from this bevy of communist, you know, pupils of his, going back to the 1930s in Berkeley and Caltech, who were clearly communists. So I think an untapped reservoir, Ryan, maybe would be the Venona papers. If somebody would really dig into the Venona decrypts, if there's so much information about in there about atomic espionage, well, what else is in there about our favorite subject? So your thoughts about the Oppenheimer security clearance hearings, and then, you know, he dies shortly after that.
Yeah. Well, I still think that Oppenheimer may have been deeply involved after his security clearance was revoked, maybe in a less official capacity, but you know, more clandestine discussions. I think it's very plausible, and I think your comment on the Verona papers is interesting. I might mention a tool that I've created called UFODEX, UFODEX.com, which is a compendium of now about 750,000 pages, including the Verona book that sort of triggered my thought of all the declassified documents there. There's probably more that can be found in the National Archives. But that tool answers any of your questions. I mean, it has like 750 books in ufology, a vast number of periodicals and National Archives documents, newspaper clippings, and so forth. It is I'm very cognizant of the garbage in, garbage out problem in artificial intelligence. And so this tool, which is an AI tool, I mean, it has this data set, and you can ask a question, and within half a day or so, you get an answer. Eventually, it'll be more real time, but right now, it's sort of one at a time. And you can ask questions, anything you want. Why are they here? What are they abducting? What's the relationship between Verona and Oppenheimer in espionage and you know, Russian communism or communists? So you can dive into specific vertical questions like that.
Well, I remember, if memory serves, when George Knapp and his team went over to the former Soviet Union, Russia, shortly after the communism supposedly collapsed, right? And then they spoke to their fair share of former KGB, former Soviet military people. And the information he got back was shortly after Roswell, Stalin himself was reviewing some of the wreckage. So if taken at face value, if that was real, that pipeline, which existed from the Manhattan Project, well, actually going much, you know, before Manhattan Project because of all the wholesale espionage going on in America at the time. Well, if taken at face value, that pipeline still existed and then eventually fed Stalin actual material from Roswell, which to me is within the realm of possibility. And a quick point also, we often hear people skeptical about the whole UFO subject saying, well, this is all just, you know, advanced DARPA material. But they forget that the Army-Navy Joint Research and Development Board, after a number of name changes and iterations, is now what we would call DARPA. So to say that DARPA is creating all this alien information and alien technology and none of it really exists, that's like putting the cart before the horse. Because some of these key players back in the day, Vannevar Bush and Oppenheimer, et cetera, von Neumann, were directly involved with the Army-Navy Joint Research and Development Board. Just your thoughts about that before we end this first segment.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, you know, the history is the OSS got involved, and then the CIA in 47 was formed, and the Army and the Air Force were merged, were separated. And you had the OSRD, Office of Scientific Research and Development Board, and then the JRDB, Joint Research and Development Board. And then there's probably several other organizations that splintered off. And ultimately, as you described, James, that has morphed into the DARPA of today. And the Naval Research Labs has done a lot of research. Yeah. People ask, well, who's running the show today? And people often say, well, the Navy or some off-world naval type organization, which is supported by some evidence. And so the history of the research and development is where to go. I think that's a great point. I mean, Van Bush and then his follow-on guy, trying to remember the name, Grant Cameron interviewed him, and he said, yeah, I know all about MJ-12, and hell no, I'm not going to tell you anything about it. And gosh. But anyway, that's where it is today, I'm sure, in more compartmentalized zones.
Yeah, and I've made a point in my recent commentaries talking about the wartime Manhattan Project, Truman signs into law, the Atomic Energy Commission, Manhattan Project splits into a military, the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project figures prominently in the Majestic Papers, and it undergoes a number of name changes, Defense Nuclear Agency, et cetera, and then the Atomic Energy Commission undergoes a number of name changes, becomes a Department of Energy, which comes up again and again.
Department of Energy comes up again and again
in these issues. So anyhow, we've reached the end of a fascinating segment with our guest, Ryan Wood. Ryan, could you let our viewers and listeners know where they can find your material online and how to go get your books?
Yeah. Well, thank you. It's all on Amazon right now. You know, there's the UFOs Who Knows book, which we can talk about later. The Encyclopedia of Flying Saucers, which is something. The AI Ufologist, which is all about artificial intelligence and ufology. And then the original book, Magic Eyes Only, which has 104 crash retrievals from around the world. So those are there, as well as my father's work called Alien Viruses, which is another opportunity to have a focus more on crash UFOs and the whole virus and virological aspect. And then the majesticdocuments.com website, and every one of these books has their own website. If you just type it into Google, you can see that and see more information.
And again, thank you for your work, and thank you for your dad's work as well. To our dear listeners out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up, become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.